I've seen a possible future. One that could well be determined by our actions. This could be the defining moment for multiple civilizations, millions of lives.
Show me my brother's mind.
Now, you see.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, going all Benny Hill on the floor of the mental health institution.
Damn it, I was going to use that at some point.
Oh, sorry, buddy.
And we
think way too similarly.
And we have a very special guest, projecting herself across space and time, Janine Smith.
Hello!
Hey, Janine, great to have you back. Last time you were on the show, was it not talking about another of your favorite characters, the Wolf Inside, a.k.a. Ash Tyler?
It certainly was.
Yeah, okay, so we got a lot of Ash Tyler moments here, very important ones that we can discuss later on. But I think, guys, let's kick it off really strong with, I mean, we're back on Talos IV. Like,
That's right.
What I think a lot of old school fans and even maybe some newer school fans who are just learning about it the past week were very excited to see.
Oh, yeah.
Cam, is this really kind of the fan service that we wish Discovery's been doing all season long?
I don't know.
Okay.
For me it was.
But you wonder.
But I do question for a lot of, say, the TNG fans onwards. I don't know. Question mark.
Well, I was thinking about this the whole time. And Janine, you recently, was it The Menagerie that you just recently watched from the original series? No.
I watched The Cage.
Oh, okay. So I did that earlier this week, knowing that we'd be visiting Talos IV on the, if memory serves, and I'm talking about the episode name, not just, you know, an idiom here. But
I recreated The Cage in my living room.
Well, you were just doing mental projections.
That's right.
Yeah. No, I believe that. So
I was painted green. It was something else.
I think that you demanded that I put that Orion makeup on. I sadly declined. But Janine, in your case, had you not seen The Cage, do you think you would have been lost, or do you think you would have not necessarily gotten as much out of this episode as you did this week?
I mean, legitimately, this is the first week that I've watched an episode and been like, I will understand every part of this podcast.
Okay.
Because you always throw back to an old Star Trek episode and connect it.
Oh, I may throw to some.
And I very rarely understand that connection.
Right.
So I was very excited.
Yeah. So, well, that's why we're going to talk all about The Menagerie, Cam, instead of The Cage.
Well, obviously, yeah.
I did read about The Menagerie.
Yeah. Okay. But I'm curious, Janine, you know, you are someone whose first series that you're actually working your way through is Discovery. And we've established that in previous episodes you've been on. But I'm curious, what have you thought of season two Discovery?
I've enjoyed it. I think for me, I enjoyed the first season more.
Okay. And why do you think that is?
I feel that it's taking a really long time to find its feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, the first season, that was okay.
Right.
Because that's where it sort of felt out. But I felt the second season, there's been a lot of just aggressive changes suddenly.
Behind the scenes, too.
Yeah, with the showrunners. Yeah. And then suddenly, you know, Saru's threat ganglia falls and now he's acting like an adolescent. And just suddenly Tyler's back and he's a Klingon. No, he's not. He's here. And I feel a little unsettled with it right now.
Does it feel as if the show is still trying to figure itself out and that's why there's just all these different changes going on?
Yeah, and I feel it's being very reactionary to sort of fan outcry.
Which is always a great thing to do if you are a very confident creative team.
Right.
Yeah. So back to Talos, though, because I think this is really kind of getting to the meat of what the story is.
That sweet Talosian meat.
It's pulsating. Yeah. Pulsating meat, yes.
Oh, my.
But by the way, instead of getting, like, the practical pulsating brains that we saw, we had CG. And the reason I can tell is because I looked at it and I was like, oh, that's CG.
It was glowing.
It was kind of a bummer to me. I was hoping that, you know, after the Andorians, and we got to see the Andorians with, like, practical antennae.
In this episode.
We were very excited about last season. And
we had Tellarites in this episode, again, also practical.
I think we actually, the first time we saw the Tellarites and the Andorians was when Janine was last on for The Wolf Inside.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. Because I did not know what they were.
So it's all coming full circle. We actually got, I guess with, you know, four admirals. Remember back in the day, they could only afford to pay for one admiral to be on the view screen. Now they've got four admirals. Do you notice they're all like charter members, save for the Rigelians on this?
Yeah, totally.
Do you think it was a big bummer that we did not get a Rigel shout out in this episode, considering how significant that was in Pike's journey during the cage?
I mean, the Rigelians seem to be scuttled off screen when it comes to popular members of the Federation.
Isn't it weird that, like, in the cage, the Rigelians were, you know, pretty much like barbarians in, like, fur clothing, but when we saw them in the background of These Are the Voyages, they were like Ninja Turtles?
Yeah.
So the Rigelians are still a mystery here, but let's get back to the Talosians.
Yeah, so the Talosians, you know, Janine, when you watched The Cage, and I recommended you watch that before we did this episode, what was your thought of the Talosians in that episode?
I'd seen photos before, so I wasn't surprised.
Right.
I thought it was great. I love practical effects.
Yeah.
And so I was really into those characters.
And when we were kids, we went to the Universal Studios live show where there was actually actors in Talosian costumes.
Really?
Yeah.
I have no memory of this.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It was an old Star Trek experience thing at, and I think I've told this on the podcast before, but it really fits well into this podcast episode in particular. And we have new listeners, of course, because of Discovery. And yeah, there was like this live Star Trek experience at Universal Studios in the 80s, and they would just take people out of the crowd to become actors in this, and they would put them in Starfleet uniforms, and then they would have actors dressed as, like, Talosians. And it was really boring. Like, super, super boring to watch just, like, you know, mom, dad, and the kids try and, like, fumble their way through dialogue on Star Trek.
So do you think the writers of Discovery wanted to, you know,
evoke that classic experience?
Well, I guess one of them was disappointed, and they're like, you know what? I'm going to better the name and the reputation of the Talosians at this point.
But I'll say, those Talosians in that experience, not CG.
Yeah, fair enough. So, but I think what we want to think about is, like, whether they bring something to the table here that we could not have gotten otherwise from other storytelling. And for a long time, we've been kind of wondering, okay, so what is it about Spock? Like, why has this Red Angel experience, like, really shaken him to his core? And I actually do like the explanation. I think they actually hinted at it quite well with last week's episode, in which we had that, I guess, that time rift that was going on.
Right.
And they were having, the crew of the Discovery was having trouble, like, discerning, you know, like, linear time from the fluid time. And again, that was kind of a parallel with what was going on in Spock's brain.
Right.
So I do like the fact that they bring this up, and they said that it's only really the Talosians that could repair that. But based on your experience watching The Cage, Janine, I mean, was this within the abilities of the Talosians? And would Spock have known that it was really just the Talosians that could have repaired him? I just wondered if the Talosians was just kind of an excuse to be brought onto the show. I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't get that they were these great sort of mind healers from that episode.
Well, look at Vina, though.
Well, yeah, true. I guess so.
They're
that respect,
not
in the illusion,
plastic surgeons. That's for sure.
In the illusion creation side, absolutely. But in terms of, like, medical fixing, I thought that was not well established in the cage.
I guess the one hint, Cam, though, is maybe they said that their brains are so much more evolved than ours, and so that's why they have an easier time with kind of this comprehension of time, so to speak.
I feel like Spock's a good judge on these sorts of things, so I'm willing to accept his logic in this sense, in that he has enough knowledge into the Talosians that he goes, this is what I need.
Okay.
I'm willing to go with it. I can completely buy this, and I do kind of love the idea that in the kind of pre-Kirk Enterprise era, the Talosians are the fix-it guys. They can kind of deal with problems, so even when Pike comes back in the original series, like, no, we got to go back to the Talosians.
The deus ex machina.
Yeah.
Right.
But I like that, because they're actually an interesting alien species. They look cool. they bring something that feels very different to me than a lot of the other Star Trek aliens we see that recur on the show.
Well, is that just it? Have we been waiting 52, 53 years for Return of the Talosians?
Other than the Universal Studios experience, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, let me throw this out to you guys. Was the wait worth it? What we got here?
Well, I thought it felt very organic. I thought it was a really great way to do fan service while not alienating new fans who have no clue who they are.
Alienating.
Well, you know. So in that respect, yeah, I thought it was worth it.
Okay.
I have talked about how much I want to see Talosians back on Star Trek, but I could never figure out a way to make it happen. Like, I'd always say I wanted them, but then it's like, well, I don't know, maybe in the 25th century, like, they can go to Talos again or something. Yeah. Who knows? But I thought this was a really good way to dodge around the issues.
Are there going to be consequences for the crew? Will everybody be tried for mutiny like Burnham was in season one?
Yeah, that's kind of crazy in that, like, season one, it's like a mutiny is like, you're going to life in prison.
Yeah.
And then in Discovery season two, they're just like breaking rules at all costs.
They're giving Burnham the Mr. Worf treatment where we know that Worf can get away with anything.
Yeah. But I was like, genuinely, I thought the Talosians worked really well in this episode. And even the CG look, I could go with it in the sense of like, they behaved like Talosians. Like, they felt like Talosians to me. And even if the visual was a little different, it took some getting used to. It never felt like something like the Klingons, where Klingons were practical. We saw going from the, you know, Berman era into Discovery, the Klingons felt really weird. The Talosians visually took a little bit of getting used to, but they felt like Talosians right away to
like
me.
Like, there's continuity there.
Yes, mm-hmm. For sure. I never felt like I was being thrown in. It's kind of like the J.J. Abrams movies where suddenly you're thrown in there and the aliens are redesigned, but I totally go with it because they feel similar. Similar here. Like, the Talosians look different, but they felt like Talosians.
Okay. The very important thing here is, after so much mystery this whole season, we finally find out why, you know, there's this break in the relationship between Burnham and Spock. And I don't know, it was kind of what I thought it might have been. You know, essentially Spock got old Yellard at a certain point. And
that's very dark, Tyler.
Well, but you know,
there would only be one of them in this equation if that had been the case.
Emotionally, yeah. Old Yellard.
Yeah. Sure.
And so I know I was wishing it was something a little bit, you know, if I can come up with it in my own head, you know, that means it's a very simple explanation, because that's about as deep as my thinking goes.
Right.
So, I don't know. What did you guys feel about this revelation about the reason why, you know, Burnham and Spock had, like, this break in their relationship?
I was just really surprised at how young they were when it happened.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I thought it would have been when they were older as well.
Yeah, I was like,
it's going to be an uncomfortable childhood for, like, the next 10 years with both of them in the house, right?
Yeah. And so it felt like one of those things that, I mean, it didn't feel like an unnatural fight either. Like, it felt like something that kids that age.
Janine and I had that fight all the time.
Like, yeah.
Constantly.
Just yesterday.
But it felt like it wasn't bad enough that you couldn't repair it if you were in the same house year after year.
Yeah.
But it just felt really soon in their relationship for him to be like, I love you and all this, like. It just didn't feel like they built that history.
How long had Burnham been in the house by that point?
Little kids glom on pretty quick.
Oh, that's right.
Human little kids.
Well, but Spock is half human,
but he's half Vulcan.
Yeah.
So it'll take him twice as long.
Oh, okay. Is that the way the math works?
Okay. These are like dog ears.
Yeah.
Okay. But in this situation, though, like I also, like you, Janine, I thought it would have been a break that happened a little later on in their lives. And so, I don't know. I was just wondering. Okay, the thing that I do appreciate, though, is like adult Spock. And maybe we can get into Ethan Peck as Spock now that we've gotten a better taste of him. But adult Spock was like, yeah, look, I realize what you're trying to do at the time. So why did adult Spock keep declining to ever see Burnham again? Like, that's kind of what leaves me scratching my head at this point.
Maybe he had to, like, relive it in that moment to truly understand it.
But he said it in past tense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like he had already figured it out, like, long ago. So that's, again, why maybe I thought that this had happened later on in life, not when you are, like, a six-year-old.
Here's the thing. He's said that at that point he realized he had to purge his human side, which actually is interesting in terms of the canon of Star Trek, and that it never 100% made sense why Spock is half-human. And yet seems to be completely Vulcan when you get to, you know, later into the Star Trek run. And so when you have it hinge on Burnham, it kind of makes sense to me that that would be a wound he would maybe logically acknowledge now, but not necessarily would want to be reminded of the person that made him pushes humanity away.
But isn't that him having an emotional response by actively making an effort not to see her?
But didn't Spock a lot of the time have those little kind of moments?
Yeah, he's a complex character.
He has those cracks.
Yeah, okay.
Spock has a lot of moments over the course of Star Trek.
I'm not 100% satisfied, but I guess I can like wrap my head around that.
Well, I think it also does a nice explanation as to why Burnham has never been mentioned by Spock.
And will never be mentioned again.
Yeah. Right? Because it was bad enough to make him shut down, but not so bad that it would be something that he might mention later on.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, guys, look, we really didn't get much Spock other than some voiceovers and some numbers being repeated, you know, in the episodes leading up to this. We finally have a real taste of Ethan Peck at this point. What do you think so far, Janine?
Well, I'm on the other side of the looking glass with this one.
Yet another Alice reference.
I'm all turned around. No, I really enjoyed his performance.
Okay.
Yeah. I thought he had a little bit more emotion to it than some of the other actors, which I thought was nice.
Look at the state that he's in right now.
Yeah.
So I can buy that.
I thought it was a nice introduction to a new actor playing Spock.
How did you feel about his first couple episodes versus like Zach Quinto in the early J.J. Abrams movie?
I don't have too much memory mm-hmm. of Zachary Quinto. And I think that speaks to that. I thought he did a really good job sort of aping Leonard Nimoy.
Right.
Whereas, like I said, this felt different. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it stood out more.
I'm just wondering right now, where does he go from here? Because I think he's now in recovery mode, and I think we're soon going to be getting the Spock that we're used to, or the one that's is more reminiscent of, say, the Leonard Nimoy performance. Cam, is this at this point really emulating the Nimoy, you know, in your opinion?
He's eerily close. Okay. I actually, really watching this episode, I was kind of blown away by Ethan Peck. I definitely mentioned in the previous episode that I didn't quite see it visually as much.
You said he was too boyish.
I did say that, yeah, versus like Leonard Nimoy, who in the cage, I mean, Jeannie, you would agree, he's not particularly boyish.
No. His nickname was Leonard Kneeboy. Ish.
Ish. but like, I was blown away by Ethan Peck's performance in this, in that it felt like Spock. Like, when I saw Zach Quinto watching the first movie, even a little bit into Darkness, it was kind of like, this is kind of Spock dress-up. It's working for me because, you know, I think he's doing a good job, but mm-hmm. it doesn't... I'm not quite watching Spock. Whereas, like, I felt like I was watching Spock through much of this episode, which is a huge tribute to Ethan Peck, who, I mean, you know, that's a really tough job to walk into, especially in a established canon Star Trek story. Like, with the Kelvin verse, you can always be like, well, this Spock was raised a little differently. He might feel a little differently than, you know, the previous Nimoy version. In this case, I was really impressed with how well Ethan Peck could evoke Leonard Nimoy. But also, did they alter the voice digitally in some way? Because it sounded so close and the bass on it was so strong that I was like, it almost sounded like they'd done something to it in post. And I have no way of knowing that.
I certainly cannot emulate a voice like that myself. Like, it like very...
And you've tried. In your homemade Star Trek radio drama.
Well, I'm doing it as we speak, and this is the closest I can get.
That's also your Kirk and your Scotty.
I don't have range. Yeah. So, yeah, look, I think what we can do from here is see where he really goes as he settles in. And I'm intrigued. Like, I'm genuinely intrigued. I'm going with an open mind for this. I know a lot of fans are going to be like, he's no Leonard Nimoy.
Right. Yes. Well, no one is.
We get it.
And Leonard Nimoy had like 50 years of playing the character. Yeah. So, but I mean, this casting of Ethan Peck, it just feels too good to be true in the sense of like they found a really, really fantastic Spock. This character has to have many years of being milked on Star Trek on TV, right? Like this does not feel like a character. And I know we've talked about the idea of if we're going to get a Pike-led spinoff. And I'm almost like kind of unsure of that because it feels like the arc of Pike is being laid out so thoroughly in this episode. And we'll get to that later. But like, it feels like you're not just going to have Spock show up this season. Like, this feels like a legacy character we're going to see in future seasons of maybe other Star Trek shows.
Well, Janine, were you aware, and I'm guessing the answer is no, but were you aware of the big, huge kind of marketing campaign with just the casting of Ethan Peck and like how, you know, like he was trotted out to the Nimoy family and he like they took photos with him and all that. Like, how aware were you of that?
I'd heard about it. I'd heard that Spock was going to be on Discovery and that they were doing casting. And I did read about like Nimoy's family being like, yeah, we support this 100%. Yeah. And so with that in mind, I thought, well, I mean, that's got to be something.
Yeah. So look, they are making such a big deal out of it. I don't think they do that with some dudes that is only going to be in it for like a voiceover here or there or like two or three appearances.
Yeah.
Tops.
Yeah. So, do you think we could even get a Spock series?
A Spock off?
Yeah. Because if the Pike arc is a little too laid out in terms of leaving a lot of room for a series, do we just get like a Spock standalone series?
Well, then what would the Spock standalone series be if,
I don't know.
If it doesn't involve Pike?
I mean, it could be a prequel to this in some way where it's just some sort of Spock adventures. I don't know.
But would that work?
I don't
or
know.
Or is he that character that doesn't work well on his
That's a good question.
I think he needs somebody to bounce off of to be at his best. And the reason why people love the Spock episodes is because, look, we'd go, you know, 3 or 4 episodes without it being a Spock-centric episodes. But if every single episode is Spock-centric,
yeah,
it might be a tough ask for the audience.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, we'll see Ethan Peck beyond season 2 of Discovery. I think that's pretty much guaranteed, whether it's in the form of a Pike spinoff or a season 3 cameo. They'll have a nice family reunion once again with everybody in a lucid state this time.
But I love that not only in this episode did he get to really capture the gravitas of Spock and get to play through really strong drama, he even got funny moments. Like, they really gave him the entire spectrum of Spock moments to really have fun with. Like, he has his, you know, goodbye Spock at the end to Section 31 through the projection.
Oh, that wasn't him.
I know it wasn't, but it's still he gets to play it, the actor.
Yeah,
and it's
course.
Just like, he gets to do so much fun stuff in Spock in 1 hour of Discovery, and it's just really crazy to me. I think this might be my favorite episode of the second season of Discovery.
You know, so I'm watching this, and the thing that I wanted to keep, you know, in mind is whether this kind of works beyond our very obvious, like, love of Talos 4 or The Cage. Like, I thought The Cage
from the intro onwards, we were hooked.
Well, okay, let's just start with that. Like, the intro, like, grabbed us because, like, we're not watching this on streaming. We were watching this on television on the Space Channel in Canada. And so we weren't sure if that was, like, I don't know, like some sort of marketing on the actual Space Channel.
Because they do have constant promos for weekly Star Trek flashback episodes.
Do they ever? But once I realized this was going to be there previously, I was, like, in heaven. Like, I don't, Janine, is this how you really want to do the fan service thing?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it so much. When it was flashing through all the scenes from the show and then just suddenly cut to Pike, modern day, with that look he gets and sort of that eyebrow furrowed, I was like, this is the best Discovery episode yet.
The living room felt like Ed Sullivan Theater when the Beatles were playing.
It was on fire.
Yeah. Cam, from your perspective, though, like, were you kind of surprised that they would do something like this? Like, doesn't this feel like so off tone from what we expect from the very serious Discovery series?
It does. It feels very playful. But at the same time, a lot of people out there have not watched The Cage.
Yeah.
Even, you know, The Cage on the actual Blu-ray sets of Star Trek, the original series, it's like on season 3 in the special features.
Really?
It's not even in the main, you know, run of episodes in the listing. So, like,
because I watched it on Netflix the other day, and then it is literally the first option to watch.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. But so it's interesting that I don't know how many people watching Discovery have seen The Cage. Maybe a lot haven't. So I feel like this did a really good job in giving you enough of what you need to watch the episode. And the fact that it was such a fun, playful opening was, I mean, just icing on the cake. It reminded me of the opening of the Enterprise Mirror Universe, where you had, like, the alternate credits.
Right.
Which was also really fun and playful. And, I mean, I love when Star Trek has fun with the form. And this was a really, really great example of it.
And do you think it's disconcerting at all, or do you think people just kind of go with it when they see, essentially, Pike as played by one Jeffrey Hunter, or Spock as played by one Leonard Nimoy, but, you know, for the viewers, that's not who they're going to be seeing for the next hour plus?
I think they're fine with it, because they most people are watching this on Netflix or CBS All Access. it's a little different than us being confused on an actual broadcast TV channel. They know when they've pressed play that this is that episode, and they're like, okay.
But how many people do you think are out there, you know, and Jeannie, do you think it'd be weird, like, let's say you're a fan that's never, ever seen the original series before. You don't even know who Pike is. Like, you're watching Anson Mount as Pike for, like, 8 episodes now. And then all of a sudden, they're like, hey, original series flashback. Here's an entirely different actor playing him.
I have to feel like a lot of people that have never watched Star Trek before are a bit like me and look things up. Mm-hmm. So they might have been a little confused at the start of the episode. But, I mean, you also saw Spock.
Right.
And you saw number one. So you saw a couple others that might, like, cue in your mind from you've seen. And so you're aware that, like, oh, this must have been from Star Trek before.
Yeah.
And then after the episode, go online and look it up.
And I think they needed that because you got to establish Vina, too. Like, Most people do not know who Vina is. They might recognize a Talosian just as a visual, or, you know, Pike as a visual, maybe not from actually watching the episode, but Vina is a character they probably don't know.
And so this is where I wonder if maybe this episode fell a little bit short, and what the big emotional gut punches we're supposed to be following here is how much Pike is just over the moon when he encounters Vina. And If you're not familiar with that episode, or let's say you missed the previously on Star Trek, I don't know if that really lands for audiences, just because why should people care at this point? Because do they even totally explain? Well, I guess they do explain her constitution prior to her meeting with Pike.
Yeah, and I mean, even if some fans haven't seen The Cage, they might have seen The Menagerie, which also kind of lays it out. So
let's just say someone has never seen the original series before, and I think that's actually the vast majority of Star Trek fans.
I think they give you enough. I don't know that they could have done more. I think they did everything they possibly could to sell this, and it worked totally on me. Yeah. But I'm, of course, in the bag for that because I love, you know, The Cage and The Menagerie.
I'm with you.
But I think they, you know, they got Melissa George to play Vina and gave that character far more to do than I ever would have dreamed. Janine and I were joking about maybe we'll see Vina in the distance. It'll just be like, oh, there's Vina. You know, just like a little nod, like, there she is. Because who would have dreamed that she would play such an integral part of the episode? I wouldn't have.
So in the Vina arc, we've had a total of 4 episodes at this point. So it's just interesting. We can now officially track a Vina arc, which is very interesting. So before we jump to the next point, because I think this is going to be interesting. We want to dig more into the Pike stuff. But it's sad to say that the big omission from that previously on Star Trek thing was Spock. We never got to hear him go, "The women!"
We also never got to see Dr. Boyce.
Oh, I didn't. Oh, Cam, you've heard me clamoring for Boyce for, like,
that's a sentence that's never been said in the history of human existence.
But oh, man, we never got the Boyce shout out. And I think, this kills me because I fear very much if we ever land on the Enterprise, we're not going to get to see Boyce on that ship. It's only going to be number one, Spock and Pike that we're familiar with.
Even number one feels like a question mark at this point.
Well, you know, I think you cast Rebecca Romijn for a reason, much like you cast Ethan Peck. Big name Ethan Peck.
Right. Yeah. Well, Gregory Peck's, you know, grandson.
That's what I'm talking about. Guys, the Pike journey, though, like, I think this is very important because I think this is connecting a lot of dots between The Cage and The Menagerie. Because, Cam, I think what you're alluding to at the very beginning is this is kind of spelling out where Pike's journey is going. And do you buy kind of where he's at by the end of this, Janine, in where you left him off at The Cage, and then he still hasn't quite gotten over Vina at this point?
Well, I think going back to what you were speaking about earlier, I think they were missing that one piece in The Cage episode where Pike is talking about, well, he doesn't really want to be a captain, and there's more than this, and he wants that life and that love.
Right.
And that's sort of what Vina filled very quickly for him after stating that. And
it was a different era.
Yeah. But we didn't, you know, if you didn't know that backstory, that would feel probably a little lost in this episode. But having it, like, I understood the arc at the end. Like, I was like, cool. I know where he's going to end up, and I'm happy with that.
I was actually kind of surprised they didn't include in the flashback in the introduction the Pike double that Vina went off with.
Yeah, you know,
because they kept referencing it.
Yeah.
So I thought that we would never get, you know, like, a real you know, Pike and Vena reunion. But I thought that we were going to see Anson Mount on Talos 4.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And I was kind of surprised that we did not.
Yeah, so. I was surprised they just mentioned it a couple times as opposed to just including that in the intro.
Were you bummed out that we didn't get to see, say, the Gorilla Man or the Pterodactyl Man?
I mean, yes, but I say that every week.
Okay, yeah. But with regards to maybe connecting the dots over to the Menagerie Cam, how do you think this works with regards to where we find Pike, you know, at the end of his journey?
I think it did a really good job in establishing what Vena means to Pike, because we, you know, you look at the character of Kirk. Kirk had many loves on the show that were portrayed just as strongly as the Pike and Vena relationship, right? And, you know, as 60s TV went on, it was, you know, the next episode is a whole new thing, right? Episodic TV. But whereas, like, Pike, because Jeffrey Hunter only played that character the once, we never really got any fulfillment to that. We just got, you know, the kind of alternate ending to Pike when we get to the Menagerie, where they just use, you know, old footage to make kind of an ending for that character.
It's kind of a fake ending that I kind of thought was great. Yeah. Just the way that they edited it.
For sure.
Yeah.
But we never really had a sense of, like, yeah, Vena was the great love of his life. And I think this does a really good job, this episode, in filling in that gap that gets us from the cage to the Menagerie, in, like, feeling like, yes, that is the fate that makes the most sense for Pike, as opposed to the most convenient one.
Right.
I do question, like, when Discovery finishes its run with Pike, and, you know, Star Trek fans who never watched the original series continue onwards, are they, like, kind of confused as to the fate of this character or what it all means because they haven't watched The Menagerie?
I don't think they should be.
Yeah.
Like because I think it's also good if there's, like, mystery going forward. And, like, the one whole hang-up that I do have about a potential Pike spinoff is we know the ultimate fate of this character.
Right.
We also know the ultimate fate of, say, Spock. So, I don't know, maybe the Commander Nan, who, if she's on the show, we'll wonder if she's safe week to week, or same with Number One, or maybe we'll find the ultimate fate of Dr. Boyce. It's just, but the thing is, if you have, like, two main characters who you know how they eventually meet their ends, it does remove tension and some sort of stakes from a potential spinoff series. And I'm glad that they don't need to spell it out, you know, handhold a lot of fans. Who even knows what their plans are for Spike through to the end of this particular season?
You said Spike.
Did I? Okay, we've been doing that a lot. So.
Yeah. That seems to be a theme on the podcast this season of Star Trek.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny.
So, guys, okay, so we've got this Talos stuff, and it kind of ties into the Red Angel mystery that's been going on as well. And we're getting more and more of the blanks filled in, which I do appreciate. I think they should have been doing this sort of stuff a little bit earlier on, you know, versus episode 8. But look, we're more than halfway through the season.
I'll take whatever I can get at this point.
Well, Janine, are you engaged now, or are you invested in this, you know, fight for the future that they're spelling out with regards to what the Red Angel is doing?
The Red Angel stuff was sort of secondary for me. I didn't pay too much attention. I was kind of like, at some point, I'm sure this will pay off. But I thought this episode did a really good job of making it engaging. Like you said, like, episode 8 felt a little late.
Right.
To finally be doing this.
Yeah.
But I'm really glad that they did it now.
I think what we can do now is kind of look for, look, I'm far more excited about this Red Angel arc than I have been at any other point in this season.
Well, this felt like the first time they were actually giving you something to hang on to.
Yes, exactly.
In the past, it was just like, well, there's a Red Angel. And you're like, why should I invest myself in this moment? Because I know it's not going anywhere in this episode.
You're like, okay, well, now this is why we should care. It's like, it's a fight for the future. Although the 25th century is a little far away. So,
sure.
Know, I still got lots of time to save the universe.
And it's interesting in that Spock having the communications with the Red Angel was, I thought, actually kind of a nice little nod to Star Trek the Motion Picture, where we have, like, Spock is the one that makes communications with V'ger. And we see that Spock has this history of being able to make communications with these very intelligent, like, life forms that no one else understands. He's sort of our figure for doing that sort of thing. So it makes sense to me that Spock is actually the one who can communicate with the Red Angels in some way.
So next up, he'll be communicating with Arim and trying to
figure
out, maybe he'll uncover that mystery that Tyler got hilariously blamed for in this episode. Yeah.
Tyler is the whipping boy of Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah, but you know, I think this is actually Tyler's best episode of this entire season by, like,
That's not hard.
It's not hard, but I think it's actually by a pretty big margin at this point. Just look, he was actually being smart. Like, he said to Pike, look, just trust Burnham. Like, yeah. She's going to be the one to see him through this. If you keep searching, maybe you'll find her, but you'll tip off Section 31. He's doing the smart thing. And look, his very unfortunate confrontation with Culber... What else can he really do in that situation other than try to apologize, explain himself, and then just do a little bit of self-defense until Culber gives up?
I have a question, though. If you're a Section 31 operative, a Star Trek security chief, I would think you'd be able to stop this fight very quickly.
But I think he was letting Culber do that, though. Very much like Saru said, and as you alluded to earlier, the changes going on in Saru's body, Janine. Saru's like, this must play out.
I thought that moment was amazing. And also, I want to see the Dr. Sue counselor series.
Dr. Sue?
Dr. Saru.
Oh, Dr.
Saru. I want to see an episode where Saru comes up with creative approaches to problems.
He should totally tackle the Worf and Alexander relationship.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Because I thought when Saru was like, let this play out, I was like, this is not what I expected to that character to ever say.
Well, but Janine, do you think... with regards to his Vorahai experience that he had just a few episodes ago, what do you think the new Saru and how it's playing out aboard the ship?
I've never been a huge Saru fan.
It's ironic because he's so tall.
I just find him a little bland.
Okay.
And so this sudden...
That's why you're an Ash Tyler fan.
I am a huge Ash Tyler fan. With Saru, yeah, I just always felt he was a little bland, a little boring. And then he got his threat ganglia cut off. And, you know, you're getting some funny moments. Him playing off a Pike can be really, really enjoyable. I just don't know. Again, it's another sudden character swing.
Right.
But I'm just not sure where it's going. Is it going to swing again?
Cam and I, we've brought that up about whether it was too soon for Saru to have this swing. I could totally buy this swing at a certain point in the series, but when you do it halfway through season two and where we've literally only spent, 20 episodes with this guy?
I don't even think that was halfway through. I think that was like a quarter of the way through season two. Wasn't it Obel for Charon?
Maybe about a third of the way through.
Yeah, like it... But I mean, it was very early in a second season to be making this decision for this character, this radical readjustment of a character.
Mm. Yeah. That said, look, I am kind of intrigued where they're ultimately, like, they must have a goal in mind for what this means for the character by the end of the season, right?
I think so.
I imagine so.
So
it doesn't feel like it's an adjustment to a character that they feel really compelled to explore around the time it happens.
Yeah.
Like, in a serialized show like Discovery, I can't help but wonder if it would have been smarter to have that sort of change maybe, I don't know, in a third season and actually spending some of your serialized arc on the Saru story.
Speaking of kind of willingness to spend time in a serialized story with characters that are going through some big, big changes right now, the Culber and Stamets stuff.
Yeah.
I find this from a narrative dramatic perspective very grating to watch.
Right.
I like both the characters. This is not very interesting drama. Like, every single beat I thought would play out indeed played out. Like, they're not doing anything interesting and subversive with this experience here, and I'm kind of bummed out. I think they're kind of doing a disservice to them as a couple. Like, Stamets seems incredibly naive, you know, like,
hey. Janine, you were mentioning that to me just the other day, actually, that you felt that way about Stamets.
I was just so enraged that a man of science cannot understand the impact that something like that could have on a person and the severe PTSD that Culber's going to go through. And he just, you know, they've written some amazing things for Stamets, and he's had some great ability to perform. And this last few episodes, he's just been walking around with this goofy grin and, like, really touchy-feely.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, you know, someone after a car accident doesn't want someone to touch them necessarily for a while. This guy died.
Yeah.
And so
he's has entirely new skin. You know what I mean? He's in an entirely, while this body looks exactly like the old one, it's still an entirely new body for him. And his entire, like, consciousness has been adjusted in some way. And it's like, yeah, I don't know that I want, like, you know, hands around me and just, like, someone who's always just, like, there. And, well, like, it would really You wouldn't even be comfortable with yourself, well, much Cam, less someone else.
If I had known that this entire time, I would have been treating you differently, okay?
But also, is no one else really bothered by the fact that Discovery has really taken no precautions to help this man adjust? They're letting Ash Tyler wander around. Mm-hmm. And not being like, you know, maybe we should make sure that they're kept separately, because that could be pretty damaging for Culber to see right
now. Yeah, that was actually
right
kind of clunky. And the fact that they're like, you know, we'll have Tyler's quarters moved to another duck. I like to think Ash Tyler walks back to his cabin that day after a long, hard day, and all his stuff's gone. And he's just like, oh.
I do like the fact that that shot, we just saw the back of his head.
Yeah.
It just seemed like it could have been his body double in that day. I don't know. We all kind of chuckled at that moment, and that's not what I think the director or the writers wanted us to do when we saw Ash Tyler slink by the victim. It's
The thing with, I guess, getting back to Dr. Culber, the problem is, it's like...
He doesn't like his soup.
Well, you know, this character was, as evidenced in season one, dead. And obviously fans very much wanted him back. And so you could tell the writers were really jumping through hoops to get that character back in Saints of Imperfection, that episode that we did not like. And they did it, but it's almost like it wasn't enough to just bring the character back and, you know, have maybe some PTSD, but get back to kind of sort of business as usual. It's like they're like, no, we need to work extra hard to justify this and have this character go through a radical journey. But I can't say that the journey so far is proving to be that compelling. Like, I think
it also doesn't work when, like, we haven't seen Culber in, like, two episodes.
Exactly, yeah, that's
just
a big problem.
It just seems so, like, kind of, like, stunted sort of, like, development with the character.
I don't have a problem.
Has he been in sickbay for a month, not been able to even visit his quarters for the first time since he came back? Like, that's another weird thing. Why hasn't he been in his quarters yet?
Yeah, I don't have a problem necessarily with the character going through this issue, but it's more of the sense it just feels like, I mean, this is, like, the B story, I guess, in this episode. Sometimes even feeling like kind of the C story.
Yeah.
And it's like this sort of thing, I feel like you need to layer this much stronger.
And if you're going to do that, I'd wish you'd do it in like a different way. Like the fact that I kind of predicted every single beat as is going to play out. Like, again, I'm a very simple-minded person. And like, I just wish that they were doing something more subversive. Or like, what if he came... What if Culber was one in denial? Hey, everything's all right. And Stamets was one saying, no, you need to deal with this. At least that would be a little bit different. But I don't know. It just Stamets isn't looking great in this situation. And Culber isn't either. Although I completely understand why he's having so many issues. But I'm just not loving how they're dealing with this storyline. And the problem is, I was very fearful this is exactly what was going to play out.
Yeah, I think you actually said you were concerned it was just going to be a way for them to create drama in the relationship between the two, which is never that fun because we like seeing them together.
Yeah, that's why they brought him back in the first place, is because he's a likable character.
Like, viewers are not excited to see these two, like, yelling at each other and storming away.
Has Culber had any likable moments since his return, Janine? We've seen him in three episodes so far this season, and His best moments was when he was eating, like, ants, like, aboard, like, that.
He wasn't eating the ants?
Well, I don't know. You know what I mean.
Oh, my God. No, he's not a very likable character. When they started out, you loved their relationship. You loved them. And then they killed him.
Yeah.
And, you know, for lack of a better word, we went through all a very traumatic experience having that character killed off.
Right.
But it happened, move on. Then suddenly they bring him back. And you're like, okay, that's weird, but sure. And then they write the most boring story arc of him coming back.
And convoluted.
It's convoluted. Yeah. It's boring. It drags down the other characters that they involve in it, except Ash Tyler.
Literally, Stamets' tears made a connection between the two across these Spore universe. Yeah. I'm just like, oh, that's a little on the nose, guys.
I'll argue that Culber had, I think, one likable moment, like one endearing moment, which was
Ash Tyler.
Actually, two. Make that two. I kind of like that moment. I like seeing that Culber is like a pretty tough guy. Like, I like that, you know, he was going, I think so. He's going like toe to toe with Ash Tyler. I'm like, You know what?
You know
I wouldn't
what?
Have expected this.
That was not toe to toe. Ash Tyler was pulling back. Okay.
Yeah. But I never would have expected that out of a Star Trek doctor. You know, for example, if like Beverly Crusher flew at someone, or if
Dr.
you know
Boyce.
Dr. Boyce or Dr. McCoy, I would never expect them to look like they can actually, you know, throw a punch or be actually, you know, somewhat competent physically.
I can imagine season 6 EMH doing this though.
Yeah, I can see that. You can picture like Carl Urban in the J.J. Abrams movies.
That's true.
You know, but normally that's not something you see in most Star Trek characters, other than really security characters or like your Kirk or your Riker type characters.
Yeah.
So I kind of like that. I thought it was just interesting to see. But yeah, I think Culber, I was going to say, the one moment that I think shines probably the best is when they're in the mycelial network and he's saying like, just leave me behind. You know, you've got to move on.
Right.
And it gave that character kind of that graceful farewell and then took it away very quickly. But it did give that character a certain moment. And we haven't gotten that sort of thing yet. We've gotten this. I mean, you know, at least I feel like the show is on a track to eventually restore Culber to a state in which he is the character that fans love. Like, I don't think they're going to create this really aggro, angry character from this point forward. That would be very strange.
It's just, how much longer are we going to have to endure a really unpleasant storyline?
Sure. And
like, that's my problem right now.
Not only that, but I would imagine, at a certain point, Culber will be a doctor again.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, why is he on Discovery?
I know.
Right?
I think that what they're doing right now is honoring the fact that he has gone through a very traumatic experience. It just doesn't make for necessarily the best television. And that's kind of, but the thing is, like, what else are they supposed to do? Like, the things they...
I have an answer to that, actually.
They've written themselves into their own, like, corner here.
I actually really think it would have been interesting to have an ongoing, you know, subplot where it's actually, like, Culber with a, like, therapist on the ship going through the process of getting back to life on the ship. I would actually like to see that.
That goes back to our Deanna Troi is the Red Angel theory that we had the other week.
Yeah. But we don't have any other counselors really on Star Trek other than Ezri Dax and Deanna Troi. But I actually think that would have been a really interesting story to see. Maybe if they'd set up the doctor, the female doctor on Discovery. What's her name?
Dr. Pollard.
If they'd established her maybe as a regular ongoing character, we could have had something like that. But it doesn't seem like they're that invested in that character at this point.
I think she was there kind of to fill in for, because we didn't even meet her until after Culber died.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Guys, I got to give let's do our obligatory Section 31 chat. Cause, in the background on that Section 31 ship, there's a crew member wearing a sleeveless tee. Which
I did not notice that.
When you watch it again, like at the end of the episode on the bridge.
Did it have a skull and bones on it?
Well, I'm just like, this is like the most goth sort of version of Star Trek we have ever seen. I was just like, okay, Starfleet in a sleeveless tee. It was amazing to me.
All their scenes are scored to Nine Inch Nails.
But I mean, guys, Leland is just looking like the most cliched sort of like...
Leland is losing me.
Antagonist. You know, like, he's just not interesting, is he?
Well, how did he get to be in charge of Section 31? Like, well, he just seems like he's constantly screwing everything
up. Well, he's not in charge of Section 31.
No, but
he's...
Well, he's like the
didn't
captain?
Pike,
the captain?
No, remember Pike said, I see you're heading up Section 31
now. But then he's always referring to Control.
But isn't Control like their AI that they were referring to? Now, see, that's
maybe.
I think that's what Georgia was complaining about. She's like, in my universe, I tell the AI what to do, not the other way around. I think that Control is the AI.
Okay.
That's my interpretation.
I thought she was talking about the holograms.
Like the admirals.
Yeah.
She was talking about, she said AI.
Did she say that?
Because remember, the hologram said that we'll send it back to Control and they'll calculate your request to find out the medical facilities. And then she came by and said, in my universe, I gave the orders to the AI. So I'm thinking Control is not an actual, you know, group of people, but like an AI, and I guess...
Like a HAL 9000?
Sort of, which seems very problematic to me. Like, incredibly problematic.
Well, he's saying Section 31 isn't problematic?
Well, just from, like, a practical perspective.
Right.
Though, it's just like, okay. So, I don't know. Like, just the more we find out about Section 31, the dopier I think this is. Like, they're trying to make it look all badass and great. Yeah. I just, like, I think it's so dopey and, you know?
I want to smash cut to the control at some point where it's just like, Daisy, Daisy. Yeah. Leland's
star child. That's what we find out.
He's got the shaved head and everything. He's flying through space in like a ball of light at the end of season two.
I can't wait.
Now, Janine, what have been your thoughts about Section 31? Because you weren't as familiar with them as obviously we were.
No, I had no knowledge of what Section 31 was.
And it shows.
So I have nothing to say.
Right.
No, so I didn't know that they weren't known.
Right.
Well, like in the other series, I just thought
you wouldn't know it from this show.
No. Yeah. And so, like,
Amanda knows what Section 31 is.
Everybody knows who they are. And yeah. Everybody knows, but I don't quite know
right
who they are and what they do.
You don't think it's been laid out very well in Discovery, is what you're saying, basically.
No. And my confusion came even more in this episode when Pike took Tyler's badge.
Right.
Because it sort of made it feel like Section 31 runs basically everything.
Right.
But then the captain just took away one of their badges.
So I had the same thought, actually.
Is that a thing?
Yeah, because...
That was bizarre to me.
Because why would Pike take away the badge of this outside group?
What if Sisko went up to Luther Sloan Cam...
Sure.
And, like, I don't know, took off his, like, some sort of insignia that he may have had on a uniform? Like, would Luther Sloan care?
Or what about, like, real-world scenario? Like, a fireman walks over to a police officer and takes their badge. Like, they'd be like,
someone's getting mace in the face.
Well, yeah, it's like, you know, they would be like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense. And so, like, in that moment, I was kind of like, and then my first initial thought trying to justify it was like, well, we know that, like, Ash Tyler's there as, like, the special liaison. Yeah. So maybe that's the purpose of the badge he's wearing. But
everybody has those Section 31
badges. I know, that's what doesn't make sense.
Well, and also, I think it was the last episode, Tyler started pulling rank on Pike about things.
Throwing
and
that's his badge.
Yeah, throwing his badge, and that's where Pike's like, Chair outranks the badge here.
Yeah.
So
does it?
I don't. So I
want to know the ranking structure of a ship where you have a Section 31 person on there.
Yeah.
You guys are trying to use logic and rationalize this.
Like Spock.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, I think the writers were just doing it for dramatic effect, though. Like, I think that's what it comes down to.
And that's fine, but the problem
but you're confused.
Is I'm confused.
Yeah, exactly.
Is who is Section 31? How? Because Leland's basically saying, like, oh, you got to report to Starbase 11 for... So, this and that, and I'm like, okay, so they're in charge, but then he can take a guy's badge, but then...
Yeah, because the admirals are talking to Section 31, saying, you've got to bring Spock to us. So the admirals are giving orders to Section 31, so then who is Pike to be grabbing the black badge off of, like, Section 31 people on his ship?
Maybe he's like, look, I fear my ship is in danger, and I'm just gonna do this. Like,
I guess.
I'll confine him to his quarters, regardless of whether I have the authority to.
We've seen on this Discovery ship that they'll not exactly stick to rules. Yeah. That they will in a moment.
But then
know.
Why did like he took Ash Tyler's back, and Tyler was like, "Oh,
yeah, that's like, true. That's a common Ash Tyler response."
Well,
though.
I know. But if it meant nothing, yes. He just would have been like, "We both know that means nothing, Pike."
Well,
and
maybe after the incident with Culber, Pike was like, "No, this is how you get Voke to come out." I figured it out.
Take his badge.
Yeah. Again, Voke's been purged. There's no Voke to be had.
So I'm curious, Jean, how have you felt about the Section 31 stuff's obviously been a bit muddy for you, but how about just the dynamics of Leland and Mirror Georgiou?
I'm loving Michelle Yeoh.
Yeah.
This season. I think she's amazing.
She had a great moment in this where she's like, I'm really busy. And then goes to like back and then drinking tea.
Lifts up her tea as she drinks it. I think she's just having the best time.
Yeah.
And it shows and it works. Leland, I really like to start with, but he's just acting like a fool.
She needs a better foil.
Yes.
Like, it feels as if she's really punching down,
but
like, every single episode.
But it also feels like they're downwriting him.
Yes.
Like, it started out, and it felt like, oh, he was going to be a challenge for her to take down.
He's the one that came to, like, recruit her in the first
place.
Right,
and in every episode, they just make, he does these bonehead things. And almost every scene between her and him, he says something stupid, she says something how she trumps him, is going to trump him and take his job, and then struts out of the way.
Yeah. And then he does something that, like, it just makes him look like a failure at the end of the episode, which is not the best thing to do to someone you want to be somewhat of an antagonist.
Can't Leland just, like, shunt her off the ship? Like, yeah.
I don't know why he has her there at all.
No, because she blackmailed him because she knows that he killed Burnham's parents.
Yeah.
Or was part of that.
Yeah.
If I was Leland, I'd be like, yeah, go ahead and tell Burnham that. Like, what do I care?
But I'm also
that's true.
If the end result is Georgia to take over Section 31 for a spinoff show or whatever, don't you want her taking down a worthy adversary?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree 100%. Yeah, like Leland feels like the kind of like villain you would see in like a really weak movie.
Right.
Where he's just kind of a dope the whole time. And then his final scene is like him like pleading for his life.
Right. And it's a bummer because I think he started out in the first episode or two he showed up.
He seemed intimidating somewhat.
Really, really
and
strong.
And he had that episode where he was going like toe-to-toe with Pike.
Yes.
And it was about them like kind of squabbling and having to work together. And I thought, okay, like they're actually establishing this character of Leland as somewhat of an equal to Pike. And now he is nowhere near Pike level.
No. So
he's more like Ash Tyler level.
He's one character who won't be getting
that's quite enough.
I remember you said you thought Leland was dead by the end of the season. I think I'm on board with you at this point.
Yeah, I don't see where this character goes. Like, he's not cool. Like, that's just the problem. He's not a cool character.
Despite what the black leather indicates.
They need to go to Sleeveless Tea next episode.
All right. Well, guys, any final thoughts? Like, maybe anything we didn't jump on, you know, with regards to this one? Which, you know, Kim, going back to something you said earlier, I think this is definitely one of the stronger ones. This might be your favorite. Mm-hmm. I need to think about that. I think New Eden is still up there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that they're telling kind of a good self-contained story that works on its own, and I understand what the stakes are. They're doing some real cool things within the confines of kind of this time period, which is what I wish they'd do more of.
Right.
I think this is a good solid one. I think this is where, you know, maybe we have Michelle Paradise is making her mark now. We, of course, know that she started helping out with regards to all that showrunner upheaval, and she's going to be the co-showrunner in season 3. If this is kind of the start of that era, I'm thinking, like, look, the ship's in good hands right now.
Don't you feel like the last couple episodes, at least, the last two or three, have been way more confident than the ones that came earlier?
Yeah.
Like, the premiere was very strong. New Eden was very strong. But then we had, like, a few in a row that were really jumpy.
I mean, like, to me, the ones that stick out, Point of Light, Saints of Imperfection, those are just kind of, like, definitely bottom of the barrel for this season.
Yeah.
You know, and other ones were the other issue is, like you said, like they're all just kind of going all over the place. And it's just hard to track what the story was. So, look, I think they are figuring things out. We're seeing signs of that at least the last 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy with that.
Yeah. I did have a question for you guys. How did you feel the the trips into Spock's mind worked visually? Because that's something, you know, we've seen on the original series a lot with the mind melds and all that sort of thing. We've seen a lot of, you know, mind-to-mind communication on Star Trek. What did you think of this Talosian-induced trip into Spock's mind?
I'm of the mind unless it's Michel Gondry, like, directing, like, a dream sequence, it's usually not the most engaging. But the thing that I did like from this is how they're cutting between the different child actors and the adult actors, and there was some incongruence within the mind, and I like the way that they tackled that. I thought it was interesting to me.
Yeah, I would agree. I enjoyed it. I thought it was a really neat way to tell a story.
It reminded me a lot, actually, of the 2009 Star Trek, where you had the mind meld with the older Spock, and you get all that exposition dump right there, but it's kind of bouncing around. It feels lively. It doesn't feel like it's just kind of this really dry exposition.
Didn't the animal that attacked...
Oh, that's another note I had, was that animal looked exactly like it was from the 2009 Star Trek.
Yeah. So,
it also looked like Starship Troopers a little bit.
This animal can obviously endure on desert planets as well as ice planets. So there you go.
Are these things just living on Vulcan?
I don't know.
I mean, Vulcan must be a really dangerous place if you got these things jumping out of the dirt.
Hey, man, don't... Like, you guys live in North Van. Like, you go walking too high up the mountain, you're going to get cougared. Mm-hmm.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. but, I
mean... Cougared.
Cougared. That could mean two different things. But
maybe
I
meant it to.
You know, there is a nudist colony, actually, up the hill from our house. Mm-hmm. So you could get cougared.
How is it?
I've never been. But, yeah, I think it has a select audience that does go there quite a bit.
They tend to be very old.
There was a mystique built around that place all through our younger years.
Wait, is that because I said the word cougar camp?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That's well, you said if you go up and up the hill or whatever.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, it's up in the wilderness up there. Facts that people at home did not need to know. But no, like, I think overall, like, I really enjoyed the hell out of this episode. Yeah. Like, this was one where I felt like this is the type of Star Trek storytelling I feel like I've been just, I'm sure probably annoying some listeners, just pleading for of the past. And you.
And co-hosts.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Just like pleading for, because I don't think it's unreasonable to expect, considering the sheer hundreds of hours of Star Trek that have managed to do it in the past.
Yeah.
And I get it, like,
and they don't have to be super fan servicey, no. Like overboard, but it's you know, but it's more like kind of capturing the spirit of what we want.
Yeah, and just trying to, you know, give these emotional beats time to actually play out, like giving that moment between Vina and Pike just like a couple minutes to actually have some impact. Versus, look at this, we had an episode where Vina and Pike got like, I don't know, 2 to 3 minutes to talk about their relationship. And then we had the episode where they rescued Culber. And their reunion, the Culber and Stamets reunion, was like 15 seconds. It was like insane.
That might be the low point of this entire season.
It might be. Lord knows I've referred to it the most. So.
Well, we still have to wait what happens when the Red Angel takes its helmet off and reveal that it's actually one Barclay underneath. But
well, we did find out it is human, it seems to be.
As which is Barclay.
Yeah, Janine, what do you think the Red Angel is? Do you have a prediction?
Well, at first I thought it was Spock, and then I realized that a million people thought it was Spock, and it wasn't very creative. And then I started to wonder if it's Culver.
Culver?
Yeah.
That would be fascinating.
I just was like, well, I was watching in this episode because the Red Angel, I mean, you pointed out that it looks like a woman.
Right.
And it's more of a, it does look a little bit more of a feminine figure.
Right.
But when I was watching Dr. Culver this episode, I'm like, he looks very fit and trim.
He is, yeah. And Wilson Cruz is like, a very fit guy.
He's also human, but not human.
Right.
You know, he's got weird, you know, the spore thing. So I'm like, maybe. I don't know how he would be related to everything, but I don't know what they're doing with that character right now.
I mean, at this point, anything's on the table with the Red Angels.
Yeah.
Although we can cross off the Iconians.
Fair enough. Yeah. I don't think anyone was begging for the Iconians. Actually, there were actually some people that were.
Yeah. There was a lot of people actually begging for the Iconians. Weird. So,
were you begging for the Iconians, Janine?
I sure was.
Yeah, okay.
And I guess, did we want to, before we sign off, just talk about the Picard news?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's always Picard news going on. But we cast the first two actors other than Patrick Stewart for the Picard series, Michelle Hurd and Santiago Cabrera.
Right.
I'm not very familiar with them, so I don't really know what to say.
Yeah, I've seen Michelle Hurd. She was in, I think, 6 episodes of the second season of Ash versus the Evil Dead. She played an old
Ash
flame.
Ash Tyler versus the Evil Dead?
You know what? I was going to say I wish, but no. Mm. I will take Bruce Campbell Ash over Ash Tyler. But yeah, she was like a love interest of Bruce Campbell's, an old romantic flame of his character in that season. And, you know, she was fun. Like, I thought she fit the energy of that show. But that show does not fit the energy of Star Trek at all.
Sure.
Much less a contemplated Picard show. So I don't know what to expect.
Like, to me, it's like, this doesn't...
No, and I know a lot of...
It's hard to figure it out.
I know, like, Deadline was reporting rumors that, you know, this sounds like kind of that breakdown of characters. But we are really on the fence about that. That's why we're not even talking about it, really.
No. I'm so skeptical of what came out. Like,
yes.
It's just... I don't know.
Well, I just look at it and, you know, it's like you have this very thorough breakdown of all these characters on this Picard show. What good is this information? Why is this being circulated on a show that is top secret? Like, you would never give, like, an actor or their agent this much information to go into audition for a show.
No, like, casting breakdowns are always very vague.
Yes, it might be male.
I've never once seen a casting breakdown that looks like this, ever.
No. No, it would be like male, 35 to 50, academic type.
Yes,
something
exactly.
Like that. Like, they're looking...
Positronic brain specialist.
Yeah.
Is that helpful to an actor?
Yeah.
No.
And, you know, most actors, a lot of actors at least going in for this, have never watched Star Trek. So what are they going to do? Sit there and Google positronic? Like, they're not going to use that. They're looking at these actors. They know what their backgrounds are. They're going through their resumes.
It means positive brain expert.
It's just none of this makes sense. And so I actually was really surprised when Deadline said, you know, that they felt it fit the rumors. But I've noticed no other legitimate sites have even mentioned this breakdown.
No.
So
it looks very illegit to me.
Yes,
but
me too.
Look, we're always proven wrong, Cam. So.
It's true.
Well, I'm so skeptical of this.
But I am curious. I think Michelle Hurd could be good. And we'll see. The other guy, yeah. I don't know, but I read, though, that he was, like, a hot draw for shows. Like, he was being offered several different pilots. He was high in demand, and he chose this one. And I was like, okay, I don't know this guy very well. I've never watched any of his work, but, I mean, if other shows want him, that's a good sign, I guess.
Cam, do you know what a pilot is?
Oh, do you want to tell that story? Because, oh, my God.
So we went to Fan Expo, guys, here in Vancouver. We got to see two Star Trek actors there, one Wallace Shawn as Grand Nagazek, who does not do the Star Trek conventions. Cam, would you say about 75% of the questions were all Star Trek related?
Yeah, he got a lot of Deep Space Nine questions.
Yeah, and, like, he seemed good. Like, I don't know why he doesn't go to these cons, you know? Like, he had some very controversial statements to make about the Me Too movement that I best not touch. Like, you and I both looked at each other and went, ugh. Maybe he is the Grand Nagus. but beyond that, George Takei was also there.
Yeah.
And Cam, you wanted to ask him, like, a thoughtful question.
I did.
Maybe one that he wasn't used to getting. Do you want me to tell this?
Sure, go ahead. Yeah.
You
were like the witness. I was too in the moment.
Yeah.
I'm too busy trying to get the question out. You actually got to observe it as it happened.
So you say, look, considering that The Man Trap, you know, was filmed 8th, but it aired 1st, and you're in Botany there, like, you know, you have an entirely different job than, you know, being at navigation. So how long do you think it took for the writers to get a good grasp of your character and where it was going? He pauses and says, well, a pilot film is what you film first and present to the executives. And so there, we filmed this first and the executives looked at it and they liked what I was doing. I was down below deck in the laboratory. They wanted me to be where the action was, up on the bridge. They're very, very smart executives. You had this look on your face. You're just like, and other people in the audience, they're probably thinking, and they didn't have looks on their face, but they're probably thinking, like, you didn't know what a pilot was. And
I know.
It was very weird. But the thing is, like, George Takei was not getting his facts right.
No, because the pilot was Where No Man Has Gone Before.
Yeah, but I told this story at, like, I'm doing this film class, just in the evenings, and I told this story to the class, and they all laughed at you.
Did they really?
Yeah. And actually, no, the instructor, he had this look of pity on his face. He was like, oh.
Well, because I know in that moment, I can't argue with George Takei, because the entire audience, for the most part, maybe there's like three people who know that I have actually maybe a point, or that I kind of know my facts.
Well,
but
it was really
the majority don't.
You got up to the mic and you started screaming subspace transmissions, subspace transmissions, baba booey, and then like, and then you got to the back of the line and then you asked your question. It was really awkward.
But I know that like the majority of the audience is on George's side, but he knows what he's talking about. And so I'm not going to argue with them.
You should
because
have.
Then it's like, then I'm the weirdo who's now arguing with the guy who was there. So it's like, okay, I just let it go. But I would love to know because, you know, you look at Sulu. Why in, like, the 8th episode they're shooting of that series are they bouncing him down to Botany for an episode? I would just love to know that. I think that's a really weird element of Star Trek canon that I would love to know, but the answer eluded me.
I guess you'll have to go to Larry Nemechek. He might have
You know what?
The
that's
answer.
A good idea. That's a good idea.
So.
Or maybe I'll just have to read that book I've got sitting at home.
That's true.
You know, the entire breakdown of the original series.
Janine, do you love it when you hear about Cam being humiliated in front of celebrities he idolizes?
It never surprises me.
No. So yeah, you've embarrassed yourself in front of quite a few Star Trek actors.
Quite a few.
I've only done, you know, maybe a handful myself, but with my horribly embarrassing stories. But
yeah. And the worst one was it Vic Fontaine?
Yeah, that's probably the worst
one.
But I blame you for that one because you encouraged me to go say hi. Biggest regret in my life. Biggest regret in my life. Listeners, don't ever go up to Jimmy Darren and say hi. You will regret it.
He was nice to me.
Okay.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. We'll have a video up again this week, and the last few videos have actually gotten a lot of attention, so hopefully this one does too. I guess next week, we follow up the continuing adventures of Discovery with the 9th episode of season 2. And now you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vina. Take two, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Nielsen Returns.
Okay, and Janine.
Janine, do you know who Nielsen is?
I do not.
Oh, she was the original actress who played Arium, who had to leave the role.
Oh, because of the makeup. Because of the makeup. Possibly.
And so now she's helping out with the spore drive. Again, Stamets seems to keep going back to the spore drive that was...
apparently killing an entire alien race.
And it was also, like, destroying his own health.
Yes.
Okay.
I know.
Yeah.
Don't ask too many questions, Tyler.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
And Janine, are you on the social medias?
Not really, no.
Okay. Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Daisy, give me your answer, too. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you.
Transfer complete.